So good afternoon, and welcome to the 493rd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The forum has been meeting monthly since 1983 to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. Today we are pleased to have Dr. Isaiah Wilson speaking on why America keeps winning battles and losing the peace. Very timely topic, I should say. Dr. Isaiah Wilson III is a retired U.S. Army colonel, former Department of Defense senior civilian executive, and a scholar practitioner of national security and strategy. He is the founder and CEO of Wilson Wise Consulting, where he advises leaders on security, governance, and institutional resilience, and he is a professor of practice at Arizona State University. Dr. Wilson previously served as president of the Joint Special Operations University and has spent decades working at the intersection of military power, diplomacy, and civic legitimacy. His current work focuses on the role of soft power, trust, and democratic credibility in sustaining American influence in an era of great power competition. He's also the host of the Civic Brief podcast and author of Substack, Compound Security Unlocked. Ike, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
George, thank you so much. Well, first, while I queue up my background pictures, you know, I'm a military guy, so you're probably worried already. Okay, we're in for a 500 slide or a 493 slide PowerPoint presentation, right? And so to get started on the PowerPoint presentation, no, I'm just kidding. I've got some pictures. They'll have some words on them, but I think you'll be able to see them quite easily. I'll be queuing them. And first, I want to thank all of you for this opportunity. I was talking last night at the reception how rare these types of community, from the feet up, community engagements are. I seek these out nationally and internationally. These tend to be the only kinds of events that I go to. I'm a political scientist. I used to go to all the conferences. This is the real stuff, and whenever you can find one, you seek it out and you try to grab onto it and not let go. So I hope to perform well and hope for future invitations to come back in engagements, continued conversations as we go. Treasure what you've built here. I know it's 45 years long and running, but treasure it because it's a very rare thing here. But this is how our nation started. This is where resilient democracies live, at local communities, in recovering. I'm an old pilot, so off track, off glide slope, and getting back on track. It must begin again with the local and the local community. So I want to thank you for that. Let me cue up some things here. Let's see. I want to thank all of you for hosting, but I also want to thank what I understand to be a pretty large, broader community that's going to be joining us via the radio. So I want to thank them as well. And I'll do my best to give cues. Give some cues to the slides, the pictures that you'll see, so that the radio, our folks listening, can actually follow and get a mental image of what we're doing here. Let me get started so I can finish, because the most important thing about these kinds of engagements is leaving enough time, ample time for a robust conversation. I'm going to try to provoke. I try to do that. I want to provoke so we can get Q&A. Hopefully they got some baskets of rotten eggs and tomatoes that you can throw at me for the things you simply don't agree with, right? That's all part of our heritage as Americans and an American. Small L, small D, small R. You'll hear me say that probably a couple of times today. Liberal Democratic Republic, hyphenated. We are a democratic republic, a liberal one, right? We are not necessarily on the liberal track today. I'm going to talk to you about an aspect of it, and it's going to give you an appearance just by the title, Winning Battles, Losing Legitimacy, Failing to Win the Peace. Military guy, you've got your thinking cap on, you're expecting a full-fledged, you know, military conversation. You'll get that, but what I'm going to be talking about is ultimately about civics. I'm going to be talking about small-R republicanism. I'm going to be talking to you about politics, not partisan politics, not tribal politics, but I'm going to be talking about politics. And how what we see in this paradox of how do we have an unbeatable military machinery, undefeatable in battle, right, in a literal sense of the term, but at least over the last 30 plus years, a failure to secure a relative peace as we can come to know it and for as long as we can keep it. That is an ultimate paradox, and it begins with the health or lack thereof of our civicness right here at home. Okay, so that's for me, that's a pretty short preamble. Let me get started. I want to begin by putting a simple framing slide up on the screen, and that's what you see here in front of you. What you'll see here is the core paradox again. We're going to explore today a nation that wins battles but struggles to secure the peace that is to follow. The peace that's supposed to premise the use of any type of force, economic, diplomatic, informational, and military as well. Again, today I want to talk about something that on the surface might sound like a military subject alone, but again, it's actually a civic one. It concerns a paradox that has shaped American power for more than half a century. This paradox sits at the heart of how the United States fights its wars, and the paradox is simply this. The United States is extraordinarily good at winning battles, but we are surprisingly inconsistent at winning the peace. Now, that pattern stretches across modern American wars. Wars we're all familiar with in this room, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now the unfolding confrontation with Iran. I call it a compound contagion war, right? I know we're struggling to even figure out what to call the thing because there's politics to be gained and politics to be lost by what we label these confrontations. It's a compound contagion war. And let me emphasize again, it's a war, right? An undeclared one, unless we consider declarations of wars now to be who takes the first shot, where, how, and why, right? And that's not good for a liberal democracy, a liberal democratic republic. In each of those war cases, American forces demonstrated extraordinary battlefield capability. Yet those victories often failed to produce durable political outcomes. So today I want to explore three questions. Here's the first one. Why tactical success so often fails to produce strategic victory? Second question. Why this pattern is becoming more dangerous in the modern strategic environment? And thirdly, what this tells us about the relationship between military power, political leadership, and the civic health of the republic itself. Because war in a democracy is never just a military activity. It should not be, right? It reflects the political community that wages it, right? Okay, so let me show you a simple framework to anchor this idea. Now, on this slide in front of you, you'll see three layers. It speaks to intent, action, and outcome. The strategic rationale being the intent, the military operation being the action, and the political result being the outcome. Now, let me begin with a phrase that has appeared far too frequently in my not-so-humble opinion recently in commentary about recent American military actions. You've heard this. You can do the right thing for the wrong reasons. We heard it in the context of our military operations in support of a law enforcement action in Venezuela. We're hearing it time and time again in terms of the exquisite use and utility of military force, unbeatable again, undefeatable again, and the exquisiteness of it, and that exquisiteness of it almost meaning, taking on a meaning for us, well, look at how well we did it. We didn't lose any people. We dinged a couple of helicopters. Must be good and right. Very dangerous thing. I'll get to that a little bit deeper here in a second. But that statement, it sounds reasonable enough in a way, doesn't it? Even comforting. But in matters of war and statecraft, it is profoundly misleading, because that phrase collapses three distinct dimensions of judgment. Again, intent, action, and outcome. You can see them on this first slide. Intent is a strategic rationale, action is the military operation in this respect, and outcome is the political result. Now, in every everyday life, we often blur these distinctions, but strategy cannot afford that luxury of that blurring. Military operations derive their meaning from the political purposes that they serve. You first and foremost have to understand and in different ways declare what those political purposes are to have your measuring stick. right? If the strategic rationale behind the action is flawed or frankly absent, tactical success cannot redeem it. Let me say that again. Tactical success cannot redeem a wrongly flawed, framed, or absent political object, a political purpose, right? In fact, tactical success often obscures the deeper strategic errors that produced that action in the first place. We're starting to get a sense of the paradox. This misunderstanding has shaped American strategy for decades. The United States possesses extraordinary military capability, yet battlefield success has often failed to produce durable political outcomes. The result, again, this paradox. A military unmatched in tactical excellence paired with persistent strategic frustration. Now, let's look a little deeper at the three familiar wars, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. During the Vietnam War, American forces won the overwhelming majority of battlefield engagements. Superior firepower, superior mobility, superior intelligence. Yet those victories did not produce the political legitimacy necessary to sustain the South Vietnamese state. In fact, we erased an entire state in the state and nationhood identity of the South Vietnamese as a result of that war. Yet those victories did not produce the political legitimacy necessary to sustain the South Vietnamese state. The same pattern appeared in Iraq, all right? Let me shift us to Iraq for a moment. What you're gonna see here on this slide is a representation of the 2003 Iraq campaign. Rapid, decisive, and operationally extraordinary. You're gonna hear me use that word a lot today. In 2003, the United States executed one of the most impressive conventional military campaigns in modern history. Within weeks, Saddam Hussein's regime collapsed, but the political architecture required to govern Iraq afterward had not been designed. Right? This got me in a bit of trouble back in 03 and 04, because evidently I was the first and at the time the only official voice that made a public declaration that despite our war-winning strategy, our campaign plan, we did not have an operational-ready plan for the rest of it, for the peace. Tom Ricks wrote an article on it. It's the beginning of his book, Fiasco. I got calls on Christmas Day 2004 to report to headquarters, and luckily I had my uniform already ready to go. It tended to work out okay, but for a young major to be the first public voice speaking to this dilemma, where was everyone else above me, and why was a young major speaking to this? That is a haunting problem which still haunts me to this day, right? Again, that rapid military victory was followed by insurgency. We weren't allowed to call it an insurgency for at least 6 months before General Abizaid, November of 2003, made the first public statement. We knew what we were fighting on the ground at that point. We knew the war had changed multiple times in the preceding 6 to 8 months, but we were not even allowed to declare it such, right? Problem. Now Afghanistan. This image reflects a similar pattern. Initial collapse of the regime, followed by a much longer and more difficult political struggle. The Taliban regime collapsed quickly in 2001. But the political institutions necessary to sustain stability proved fragile. And 2 decades later, well, we know what happened. The Taliban returned. Notice the pattern. These failures were not caused by military weakness. You'll hear me repeat this a couple of more times in my presentation. They occurred despite extraordinary military success, which again reveals the paradox of the American way of war. Unmatched tactical capability paired with persistent strategic disappointment. In fact, I'll state it even more bluntly and baldly. The paradox of the American way of war is that our American way of war isn't. It is not a way of war. It is a way of battle. And it is a way of war fighting and use and utility of military force in a very direct action kinetic approach more often than not. And we are conflating war with that type of kinetic battle. And you can see what it produces: exquisite, unbeatable tactical actions that bedazzle us to the point where we forget that exquisite action should only have any purposeful meaning in the political object that we've already declared that it's supposed to serve, right? If we don't do that last part, the military action becomes an in and of itself. And that's the story of Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and more than likely Iran, where we are today. Next slide. Let me bring this slide up. Captures the modern battlefield. What you see here are the tools of contemporary war: precision strike, special operations, and network capabilities. Now, modern technology amplifies this problem, this paradox. Again, precision-guided munitions, special ops, raids, cyber capabilities, these tools produce immediate and highly visible results. Targets destroyed. Think of the things that we count as whether we're leading or lagging the action, right? Targets destroyed, the equivalent of body count from Vietnam. Leaders eliminated, decapitation actions and efforts, networks disrupted. But political outcomes unfold on a completely different timeline. Now, this next slide is especially important. You'll see two gears, one small, one large, turning at very different speeds. The smaller gear represents tactical time, right? We count tactical time in hours, days, weeks. The larger gear represents political time, years, decades, institutional trust, governance, legitimacy. Let me build on that last visual with this one. This slide illustrates what I call the tactical mirage, the illusion that fast military success equals strategic progress. We're all susceptible to this. The danger is that rapid tactical success creates the illusion of strategic progress. Illusions are very dangerous in strategy because defeat forces reassessment. But illusion encourages complacency, right? And this next visual reinforces that same idea. How quickly visible success can mask slower moving political deterioration. Now, you know, I can't help it. You know, I'm a teacher and I'm a pseudo-historian as well, and I spend a lot of time studying the roots and rudiments of so-called Western, you know, culture, Western civilization. You have to go back and talk to, first I stop and have a conversation with the dead Prussian, Karl von Clausewitz. I'll mention him again here in a moment. And then I go further back and talk to that military general, historian, exiled in both respects, the writer of that piece, that history, To Endure All Times, the great Thucydides and the history of the Peloponnesian War. We often in America model ourselves against the purity and the promise of Athens under Pericles, a Periclean Athens, right? As it faced, and certainly during the Cold War, we would show Sparta as the Soviet Union and the United States as Athens. Let me burst our bubble a little bit on this point, right? I want to talk in terms of what I call an American Sicilian expeditionary moment. During the Peloponnesian War, Athens was the strongest power in the Greek world. It possessed the most powerful navy, immense financial resources, experienced commanders, a vibrant and confident democracy. And at the height of that power, Athens launched their Sicilian expedition. It did not do so because it was desperate. Quite the contrary, it did so because the venture looked quite plausible to Athens. Affordable, strategically imaginative, Sicily promised influence, wealth, leverage against Sparta. The gamble actually looked pretty prudent. Now let me take you back in history for a moment. What you're seeing here is a depiction of Athens at the height of that power, on the eve of that expedition. In that expedition looked like an abundant, wealthy, positive, aims-based expedition until it exposed the fragility of the system that actually launched it. Athens did not fail because it was weak. Again, quite the contrary. It failed because success altered its judgment. Its power created the illusion of control. Its reach began to substitute for strategy. Its confidence matured into self-deception. And by the time the catastrophe became visible, the deeper damage had already been done. If you remember the story, Athens loses its entire navy, it loses its army, it's decimated, it's reduced to rubble. Its men and women that survive the carnage are actually put into slavery. By the time that catastrophe became visible, the deeper damage had already been done. The problem was not simply the loss of ships and soldiers. The problem was that the expedition exposed the brittleness of the system that was Athens, that launched it. That's why I describe our moment as America's Sicilian moment, our current moment. Not because history repeats itself neatly, it certainly doesn't. I would say it doesn't even rhyme. History doesn't repeat, but we do. We repeat history, especially when we don't revisit our histories. It fails because, and it repeats because it captures something familiar. A great power, accustomed to extraordinary capability, begins to confuse what it can do with what it should do. It mistakes operational reach for strategic wisdom, and only later discovers that the political consequences are far harder to control than the initial strike packages. Now let me put up a slide that shows how typically we think about war today. You'll see a sequence of phases: preparation phase, invasion phase, combat phase, and then almost as an afterthought, right, the political aftermath. What I call the phase four blind spot. Military planners, and I'm a military planner, we divide war into those phases: preparation, invasion, destruction of enemy forces, then finally, post-conflict governance. Wouldn't we think we probably should start in the reverse, right? You know, you can see the theme I'm going on here. Notice the imbalance, right? We invest enormous energy in the first three phases, and often treat the fourth as an afterthought. Yet historically, the political phase of war is the longest and the most difficult. Defeating a regime is not the end of the war. It is the beginning of the political project. Now, let me share a little personal moment from Iraq that has stayed with me for more than now 20 years, 20 plus years. In 2003, I was an Army major, as I explained briefly a few minutes ago. I had just completed the U.S. Army's School of Advanced Military Studies, what the military calls SAMS. It's a program designed to train planners to think about war not just in terms of battles, but in terms of strategy. Well, Iraq War had launched while I was in school. I was graduated early and sent with the director to Iraq immediately. I had like 3 days to go pack a bag and head off to the battle space. Soon after I was deployed, and I was deployed as part of a team tasked by then Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki, and our initial meeting was to study the unfolding campaign. Our job was not initially to fight, that was to come. Our job was to observe, to analyze, to document how the war was actually unfolding. That assignment gave us a vantage point that was both fascinating and frankly deeply, deeply unsettling. Because from very early in that war, it became clear that something fundamental was missing. Now, I want to say something very clearly here to you all. The invasion itself was a remarkable display of military capability. Remarkable. American and coalition forces moved with extraordinary speed. The Iraqi military collapsed far faster than most analysts expected. Within weeks, Baghdad had fallen. From a purely operational perspective, the campaign was stunning. But within days of that success, the environment began changing, and the change was visible everywhere. I remember driving through Baghdad shortly after the regime collapsed. Government ministries were looted, being looted, police stations abandoned, hospitals stripped bare, the Iraqi state was evaporating before our eyes. And as we observed this, a troubling realization began to settle in. We had planned the war, but we had not truly planned the peace. There was no operations ready phase four strategy, the phase of war that deals with stabilization and governance after combat ends. The assumption in many quarters had been that once Saddam Hussein's regime fell, Iraqi institutions would continue functioning. Remember the whole greeted by flowers, right? That whole thing? I hope I'm not triggering too many people in here. I'm in the practice of triggering myself, but I'll apologize right off the bat if I'm triggering folks with some of these memories. I'm looking at Larry here in particular. That assumption proved, again, catastrophically wrong. When the regime collapsed, the state collapsed with it. And into that vacuum poured forces we had not fully anticipated: tribal militias, sectarian factions, criminal networks, foreign fighters. Soon the insurgency began forming, that thing we were not allowed to even call what it was for a good 6 months after it had formed. And now here's the important point. Again, none of this meant American forces were losing battles. Quite the opposite. At the tactical level, U.S. units continued to perform extraordinarily well. Raids captured insurgent leaders. Operations disrupted militant networks. Patrols cleared hostile neighborhoods. But the strategic environment kept deteriorating. It was one of the most perplexing things I had ever seen as a military officer. We were winning engagements, yet the war was slipping away. Now, during that same time, General William Wallace, the Army commander who had led the invasion, made a remark that captured the moment perfectly. He said, "This is not exactly the enemy we wargamed against." That sentence has stayed with me ever since because it revealed something deeper than a tactical surprise. It revealed a strategic blind spot. We had planned to defeat Saddam Hussein's military, but had not adequately planned for the political environment that would follow the collapse of his regime. Now that dead Prussian, I have to mention him again. In war, as Clausewitz reminds us, is always about politics. Before the invasion began, General Shinseki had warned Congress that stabilizing Iraq might require several hundred thousand troops. At the time, the invasion force only numbered about 130,000. Shinseki's estimate was controversial, to say the least, at the time. It was unaccepted by the political leadership. But the deeper issue was not simply troop numbers, it was strategic design. Inside the military, many planners understood that removing a regime created a political vacuum. History shows this time and again. Germany after World War II, Bosnia in the 1990s, Kosovo. State collapse is not the end of war. It is the beginning of the political phase of the war, the decisive action. But in Iraq, that phase had not been fully designed. Responsibility for reconstruction was expected to shift quickly to some undefined, undesignated civilian agencies. The assumption was that the war would be brief, that the political phase would somehow take care of itself. Well, folks, it didn't. What we saw in 2003 and 2004 was the beginning of something that would define the next two decades of conflict. And it has a vote in this compound contagion war as well. An insurgency forming in the shadow of tactical success, local victories that could not be translated into national stability. Operations that succeeded militarily but failed politically, and that experience forced many of us to confront a very uncomfortable realization. The United States had become extraordinarily good at defeating enemy forces, but far less prepared to shape the political environments that followed those victories. In other words, we had again mastered the conduct of war fighting, but we had not mastered the conduct of war. And that distinction matters enormously because wars do not end when one side destroys enough targets. They end when a political order emerges that both sides are willing, all sides are willing, or forced to accept. In Iraq, that political order never fully stabilized. Again, the insurgency grew, sectarian violence escalated. And years later, on one of my return trips, the Islamic State would emerge from that chaos. And the United States, after withdrawing, would eventually return to fight again. Now again, let me say something important. I'm not telling this story to criticize the soldiers who fought that war. I'm one of them. American troops performed with extraordinary courage and professionalism, but the experience of Iraq does reveal a deeper structural problem. Strategy is not measured in targets destroyed. Strategy is measured in political outcomes achieved. And that requires integrating military action with political design from the very beginning. If you destroy a regime, you must be prepared to replace it with something viable. If you disrupt a political order, you must be prepared to shape the order that follows. Otherwise, the vacuum will fill itself. What Iraq taught me very personally is that battlefield success can create the illusion that a war is under control. But war is never simply a technical problem of destroying enemy capabilities. It's a political struggle between societies and the politics those societies bring with them. And unless strategy accounts for that political dimension from the very beginning, tactical success can become a strategic mirage. Oh, I think I want to stay here for a second. Now, let me take a step back even further. We're beginning to get to an ending here. On this slide, you'll see what Clausewitz called the remarkable trinity, right? The relationship between the state, the military, and the people. We arrive now at this deeper structural problem. Clausewitz argued that war emerges from the interaction of three forces. Again, this idea of reason, passion, and probability. Or in modern terms, the state, the people, and the military. Now, in healthy political systems, these three elements remain in balance. Note the equilateral triangle. Equipoise, balance, right? War policy balances equipoise in between those three forces, right? Political leadership defines the purpose of the war. The military executes strategy. The people supply legitimacy and endurance. Now, I want to show you how that balance has shifted. This slide illustrates how those three elements have begun to drift apart in modern American strategy. Over the past two decades, that triangle has become unbalanced. Political leadership increasingly operates on short-term timelines. Remember those gears, right? Election cycles, media pressure, polling. Meanwhile, war unfolds across years and decades. Think about what the Iranians are telling us today, the same thing that the insurgent forces in Iraq and the Taliban in Afghanistan told us. You Americans in the West may have the watches and the clock, but we have the time, right? At the same time, the military profession has become extraordinarily specialized. Operational excellence, technical mastery, precision warfare. But professional culture sometimes discourages deep interrogation of the political logic behind our wars. And finally, the public itself has increasingly grown distant from war. The United States fields an extraordinary all-voluntary military. But most citizens experience war only indirectly. The result is a widening social distance between society and the wars fought in its name. When these three elements drift apart, Clausewitz's trinity breaks and strategic coherence begins to erode. Now, let me introduce a model that helps explain the modern environment. What you're seeing here is a map of what I call a compound security system where military action interacts with multiple domains at once. Economic systems, information networks, technology, social legitimacy, diplomacy. Look at the diagram here. A single military action can produce cascading consequences across all three of these domains. A successful strike may degrade an adversary's capabilities while strengthening their political narrative. Sanctions may weaken a regime while at the same time strengthening nationalist sentiment. Information campaigns may shape perceptions while undermining institutional trust. Iran, Iran, Iran should be flashing in our brains at this point, right? This next slide builds on that same idea. It shows how a single action can produce ripple effects across economic, informational, and political systems. In such an environment, tactical success becomes an unreliable indicator of strategic progress. Now let's bring this into the present. As we begin to close, this slide reflects the current strategic environment surrounding Iran, where tactical success and strategic uncertainty coexist. American and Israeli forces have achieved significant tactical success. Air defenses degraded, infrastructure targeted, command networks disrupted, a navy at the bottom of the Persian and the Arabian Gulf, right? Measured purely in operational terms, these operations have been effective. But the strategic trajectory remains uncertain. Iran's strategy does not depend on conventional battlefield victory. I call it a status insurgency. And they've had 47 years of devoted effort and time in building that status insurgency, right? We're not even realizing that we're not going up against a traditional state-on-state contest here. Very problematic. That system depends on endurance. Again, remember who owns the watch and who owns the time. Regional disruption, proxy networks, political fragmentation among its adversaries. In Clausewitzian terms, the war is entering the interactive phase. We're in it, folks. Each side adapting to the other, which means the opening successes we had seen now represent not the end of the conflict, but only the beginning, only the end of its beginning. Now, let me put one more image to ground this in a bit of a lived experience. What you're seeing here reflects Afghanistan near the end of the campaign, a moment where tactical experience and strategic uncertainty collide. Years after Iraq, I spent time in Afghanistan working with coalition and Afghan partners. By that point, the war had already been going on for many years. American and allied forces had fought thousands of engagements. We had removed the Taliban government. We had trained Afghan security forces. We built ministries, schools, infrastructure. At the tactical level, the military had learned an enormous amount. But the deeper question always lingered. What political order were we actually building? One day I was standing with an Afghan officer who had trained with U.S. forces for years. He was incredibly capable, professional soldier. And he said something I've never forgotten. He said, "Colonel, you Americans fight very well. Everyone knows this. But what happens when you leave? That question stayed with me. It should stay with all of us because it captured the heart of the problem. Military success can create space. It can remove threats. It can buy time. But ultimately, wars are decided by the political orders that emerge after the fighting ends. In Afghanistan, as in Iraq, we proved again that the United States possesses extraordinary military capability. But capability alone cannot determine the political future of another society. And when the United States withdrew in 2021, the world watched something sobering. 20 years of military effort collapsed in a matter of weeks. Not because American troops had fought poorly, quite the contrary, but because the political foundations of the system we built were never strong enough to stand on their own. And that moment forced many Americans to confront a difficult question, or at least I hope we've confronted or are confronting the difficult question. If the most powerful military in history cannot convert battlefield success into lasting political outcomes, what exactly does it mean to win a war? One more widening of the lens. The slide here shifts the focus from the battlefield to our republic itself, the broader system that wages war. Because everything we've discussed today ultimately points to something larger than military doctrine. I had promised that at the beginning, I deliver near the end here. It points to the condition of the republic itself, our liberal democratic republic. A republic does not go to war merely with its armed forces. It goes to war with its politics, its institutions, its civic trust, or lack thereof, its sense of shared purpose, or lack thereof. And when those things weaken, even the most powerful military in the world begins to lose strategic traction. The problem then is not simply operational, it becomes constitutional. War in a democracy is supposed to be tied to political purpose, publicly justified, strategically disciplined, connected to a clear vision of the political outcome we seek. But when politics becomes short-term, when the public becomes detached or is intentionally detached by its political leadership, and when the military is left to carry strategic burdens that are actually political in nature, the republic, well, it begins to drift. Battlefield success can conceal that drift, but it can make a state look stronger than it really is. Eventually, the deeper misalignment reveals itself, and when it does, even the most impressive victories can prove hollow. This slide captures the core distinction between displaying power and preserving resilience. Great powers rarely collapse because they suddenly lose the ability to strike their enemies. They collapse because they lose the discipline to distinguish between actions that display strength and actions that preserve resilience. Athens, remember Athens? It remained powerful after Sicily, but what it lost was the capacity to remain itself. I worry that America is through our tactical victories, is losing the capacity to remain who we are, who we've been, and who we intend to continue to be and become again. And finally, the last slide here brings us back to the central question. Not whether we can project power, but whether we can align it with purpose. The United States today still possesses extraordinary military power. I'll end with this. The real strategic question is not whether we can destroy things. We certainly can. The question is whether we still possess the civic wisdom to align power with purpose, force with that thing we call legitimacy, and military success with political outcomes that endure. Because history suggests something very sobering. The most dangerous moment for any great power is not when it becomes weak. It is when it becomes so powerful that it begins to mistake capability for control. And when that happens, winning battles can become the first step towards losing the peace. I want to thank you and look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Ike. It's something you're talking about, a subject that is on all of our minds constantly, and you've put it in a good perspective. I always take the advantage here of being the moderator to ask the first question, and I had a bunch of questions, but I'm going to pick one. Do you think the U.S. thinking has changed at all on the need to define an end state. We seem to be, you know, you've mentioned, well, four wars now, starting with Vietnam. Yeah. We don't seem to have learned anything. What would we need to do in order to learn from our experiences?
I think the first, I'm a teacher for a reason. I never intended to become a teacher, but ultimately, I'm a lot of different things. You heard a lot in the bio. I've been a lot of different things, but ultimately, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a father, and I'm a teacher. And the reason why I am a teacher is because ignorance is a treatable condition, right? But stupid is a choice, right? And so ultimately, if you boil everything that I've ever been, done, and continue to do, it's about helping, particularly us as members of a liberal democratic republic, to become less ignorant of things. And that begins with forums like this. It begins with the hard but must-do things of getting together in communities, setting venues like this, in rediscovering, relearning together how to have the most contentious and uncomfortable conversations across all of these tribal divides, the demographic divides, and to come together into that marketplace to come up with a compromise solution that we can all live with, satisfying solution, something that none of us are getting everything we want, but just enough to where we can reinforce what the founders and framers gave us of a country of laws, not of men, as John Adams left us with, and a system built on majority rule, but always respect and a place for a hearing of minority rights. Because you never know when you're going to be the majority, or one day you might be the minority. And we're struggling with that in this country. And our adversaries, our real adversaries out there, and I know them well, too well, they're exploiting that. They're exploiting that. So I think education, I think forms like this, civic engagement, education. It is not surprising. I want to really shock you with this, and I'll pause so we can get some more questions. It's not surprising that some of the first targets of our, you know, the Trump regime were against the intellectual communities, civilian universities, your joint professional military education systems, right? Our own American-style purging, if you will. Not a harsh terminology to use, because we want to get a system placated. And you get rid of the thinkers. You subordinate the thinkers. You put a pressure campaign so that the thinkers that are still there are no longer thinking. And if they are thinking, they're quiet. The thing that haunts me most and robs me of sleep on a day-to-day basis is the quietness. I think as we get closer to the midterms, I worry it's going to get even more quiet. Right? It's not an afterthought. It's not a happenstance that those were the first targets, to include the media. The first target line, it's a shock and awe campaign. I'm a military planner. I know how to do this. I know what we've done. And I just reverse engineer our American way abroad for cause. And I see way too much of that same campaigning approach happening right here in the streets, in the communities of America. Right? So we've got to communicate with one another. We've got to re-educate one another. We've got to civically train together to take thought into action. That would be a simple, broad answer to the question, George. Appreciate it.
Billions of questions here. We'll see. Well, how many we get through?
Keep it concise.
People aren't interested. It's an interesting question. What group in our country should be creating this longer-term strategy that worries about the after the war is over, how do we win the peace?
It's probably gonna be an unsatisfying, but it's a truthful answer. It's gotta be a communitarian approach. How does the military do it when we do it very well? Just from a military premise, we do it in what's called a joint interagency, intergovernmental, multinational task force. We always task organize, bringing civilian agencies in with the military, and we create what's called a fission or a fusion process, and we have dialogues. We take intelligence from all the different agencies, military, non-military, public, private, We curate that information, we turn it into actionable intelligence, and then we act on it. We design an action plan to carry out the strategy. We constantly revisit the strategic purpose and the goal, what brought us together in the first place. You constantly revisit that. I think the same is true in terms of the Republic, the Democratic Republic at large. We need to bring the public, we the people need more auxiliary precautions, as James Madison told us, right? I'm spending a lot of my time now blueprinting what some of those additional auxiliary precautions will be, because as Madison told us a long time ago, and we're proving ourselves today, we men, in a broad sense, men, women, are not angels. If we were angels, we'd have no need for government and governance. We are not angels, therefore always a need for auxiliary precautions. One of the things I'm looking at is ranked choice voting. One of the things I'm looking at is maybe even a fourth institution that brings civic communities more into dialogue, formal dialogue with their House and Senate representatives. I'm a fan, increasingly so, of recall initiatives so that we the people can get people who are no longer representing us or giving us a transparency of what they're doing on our behalf 30 days to vacate our desk, right? And come home to be re-socialized to your community, right? Just two or three quick ideas in that respect.
Well, here, let me go back to something earlier, because it's another series of questions here that are very similar. And that is, does the military think now that it has the responsibility for the post-conflict era? I mean, I know they've geared up more since these recent wars to do that, yeah. But is the military at fault here? Because
yes.
They think that, you know, that they can do this when it's really more of a civilian process that is needed?
The military, there's a lot of myths, right? There's a huge myth. You know, I lived it as a young officer through the 1990s that the military does not do windows, right? Is that we called it back then, right? We called it, we haven't even had a doctrine for it, military operations other than war, right? Clausewitz rolling over in his grave, Sun Tzu right behind him. No. War is a continuation of politics by other means. It's a political action. If your military doesn't understand the politics, it loses its measure of jus in bello, jus post bellum, in a juice ad bellum, right? Justice of the war, justness in the war, and I say most importantly, justness after the war. And what our military action is as a follow and support role to civilian authority. I'm a strong believer and advocate, blood oath sworn, to American civil military relations and this core tenet of subordination of the military to civilian authority. Even reserving the right for that civilian authority to be wrong in their decisions, and us mitigating that risk. Sometimes it gets to such a risk beyond mitigatable to gamble where our military has to stand up constitutionally and say, well, the problem is within. And depending on your rank and station in that enterprise, in that apparatus, there do unfortunately come times where I believe that the military, to be true to our constitutional oath, must tell the emperor that they are no longer wearing clothes of ours. Right? And so we have a lot of our senior enterprise leaders, and I know all of them and I love them all. Some I've known since we were cadets together. Some have stayed too long and they're too quietist, and now you have to ask the question, where is the fidelity, and do I still have reason and cause to trust you? It's going to take a long time, folks, and the best conditions for us to rebuild that trust from within the military itself, between the soldiers, the service persons, in their senior leadership, right? And most importantly, between that same military and you, right? And so some of us are beginning the work now. These are blueprints that we have to re-blueprint. Okay, George.
Should we reinstate the draft so the populace will be more engaged? And
I think we unintentionally lost something very important when we moved away from the draft. And I think when we did, the conditions, I'm a part of the all-voluntary force, military. We got a very professionalized force. But what we lose is a liberal democratic republic in that transfer. We lose an internal check and balance, right? The protests of the Vietnam War were here in the city streets, but they were also in the line of troops in the war itself. Those are Americans saying something's rotten here in Denmark, right? In Dien Bien Phu, right? In Way City. That's an important check. When you go, how do you go 50 plus years as a liberal democratic republic with your national security defense being served by an all-voluntary force, now executively captured, and what I concern myself with becoming more and more of a Praetorian Guard, right? It's very worrisome, right? This is your military, and it has to serve you. Does that mean I'm advocating a 1972-73 draft? No, but I am a strong advocate for a 21st century, 2026, maybe 2028 national service, where service in the military is part of a spectrum, right? And I've done a lot of laying out of this. Yeah. Thanks.
Here's a question. Does the U.S. still have the tools to win the peace? I mean, we've decimated a lot of the resources at state, USAID, a lot of our soft power tools are gone. I mean, have we wasted and eliminated our...
We've lost a lot in the last 15 political? Months. We've lost a lot of that capacity, which makes it easier for this current regime to avoid the phase four question, because you can easily say, well, that's high risk now because we don't have the capacities and the capabilities to do it. This is all deliberate, folks. You go back to Trump, the first Trump administration, Steve Bannon. Yeah, I'm going to say this. I know I'm on the radio. I know. I will say it. Steve, you know, this administration, Trump 1 and Trump 2, has been very honest about his dishonesties. Steve Bannon and Trump 1 made the statement, this is going to be about a dismantlement of the administrative state. All those auxiliary precautions. That was phase one. It's a military campaign, folks. You dismantle it, you put a power pressure campaign that those are still remaining, they're shock and awed. And they're quiet and in the corners and just trying to hold on to their position. Some of that comes from a very honorable internal place of, if I lose my position, I'm not here to protect those in my charge. That's being abused. That's being abused. And sometimes you stay too long and now you become complicit. And you find yourself sitting in venues on long wooden benches next to some real evil characters, but you not being one of them, but you're still complicit. Right, you only have to go back to 1945 and the post-adjudications of that war. You don't want to find yourself. We don't want our military finding it themselves, or our State Department officials, or the USAID folks that still exist. But we've lost all that capacity very deliberately. Once you dismantle it, it's easier during a second administration to gather all those shocked and disparate, disconnected parts and bring it into your control under executive fiat and executive capture. And that's exactly what's taking place. So it's harder to do war true to form and definition and practice. And that's the point. Part of that is also relabeling the Department of Defense the Department of War. I call it a Department of War Fighting and Warfare. In fact, it's more, if you followed up my theme today, it's more a Department of Battle. And our Secretary of Defense is a battleist, right, at most. There are no warriors there in that apparatus at that level. Right? I'm making your life very difficult,
no,
George.
No, not at all, not at all. A lot of these questions have been very similar, but can you point to any time of modern warfare for the U.S. or other that have followed this proper order of goals, tactics, politics? What you've talked about?
Yes.
Are there success?
Gulf War I. Limited war, balanced war. Clausewitz would be very proud of us back then. Equipoise, balance, limited aims, limited ways and means derived from those aims. I say that in that sequence very deliberately, right? Coalition, we did not do this unilaterally. We did it as a coalition, not just of willing, but coalition of willing and able. And we brought legitimacy because the coalition was built from the feet up from the local region, right? It's one of the reasons why we got in a bit of trouble with bin Laden in Al-Qaeda is because of the success that we had in forming a robust coalition of willing and able with the Gulf partners in the Saudis in Gulf War I. Most importantly, we conducted that limited campaign, and we had the opportunity and the power to do so, to cross the berm and extend that war into Iraq. And our defense secretary at the time said no, aided by the best military advice from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs was General Powell. We remember who the defense secretary was, don't we? It was Dick Cheney, which just a few years later, you know, had a different determination, right? The irony, one thing you can always count on with American political development is the extraordinary, exceptional curiosities, these rhythms and rhymes that happen through our history. One of the greatest articulations, and I have this printed out at my home office, is the statement that Defense Secretary Cheney made in giving the public the justification, the explanation of why we were stopping short, right? We had met our goals, our stated goals. The war policy was limited. The war, by its nature, eternal, but not ours. But not ours. And that's how we came out of that war, very legitimate, more with stronger legitimacy than we went into it with.
Well, thank you very much. Very appreciate it.